last time I took a road trip? How many national parks could I hit in 2 weeks? What about hotels? Wait, hey, Erica, how much am I spending on travel?
When your questions about life turn into questions about money, there's Erica, the virtual financial assistant to help you spend, save, and plan smarter. Only from Bank of America. What would you like the power to do? Erica is only available in the English language. You must download the latest version of the mobile banking app, only available on select mobile devices. Your chat may be recorded and monitored for quality assurance. Message and data rates and additional terms may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and maybe asking you for money if we're still indoors by September. I'm Kevin Day in an increasingly rural Norbury and a long way away, 55 odd miles, I'm joined by the next Chancellor of the Exchequer, football finance expert and lecturer at Liverpool University, Kieran Maguire. Hello, Kieran, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you, Kevin.
Good. That's a lovely, for the benefit of listeners, Kieran is wearing a rather garish pink shirt today. It's very nice.
Well, you can take the boy out of Brighton, but...
Now, coming up on today's show, which is Thursday, isn't it? It is Thursday, Kieran, isn't it?
Yes.
It's so very difficult to tell at the moment, isn't it? It's Thursday. So coming up on today's show, the latest on the Newcastle takeover, more shenanigans in Scotland, I'm afraid, and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's controversial post-apocalypse transfer prediction. Very controversial for a little fellow. But first, Kieran, this is big news. The EFL and the PFA have proposed that clubs defer up to 25% of players' wages in April. Now, does defer imply later payment or no payment?
Later payment. Presumably, when clubs start to generate income again, the players will get the remainder of the pay packet. We certainly saw in respect of Leeds, when they negotiated with their owners, that they would take a effectively late payment for pay, for their wages, but that would be supported slightly by effectively an interest payment on the money that they weren't receiving on the due date in respect of perhaps their March or April pay packets.
So would this involve a separate contract or a contractual amendment? Would it involve a date whereby they would be told that this is over and we can pay you from normally from now on?
I think they would try to keep it as vague as possible at present, because there's no indication as to when football is likely to return. Clearly, we can't have football players being given precedence in terms of being tested for COVID-19 when we're not testing everybody who's on the front line of the health service.
We're testing Michael Gove's daughter, though.
I'm delighted. Is she frontline health?
No, she's Michael Gove's daughter. I think that was the link. Right, I think that was the link there. I think that's why she got the test, so Michael could go jogging with the rest of us.
Excellent news. Well, I hope he enjoys his jog. So in respect of the proposals, is that it would be 25% of pay would be paid at a later date, but that would only apply to those players who are on more than $2,500 a week. And if the 25% took you to below $2,500 a week, you'd effectively have a floor at that level. So it'll involve an algorithm, and we like algorithms, as we both know. But there is some aim for some protection for players. So $2,500 a week is that's $130,000 a year in terms of sort of the gross pay of players. I think it really is important to get it sorted before the April pay packets have been organised, because if you take a look at the wage bill in the Championship, that's going to come to around about £60 million gross in April, and clubs have got no money coming in.
So would this be voluntary in that clubs could volunteer to opt in or out, and if a club decides to do it, could a player then decide to opt in or out?
Well, it does appear to be very woolly in terms of the PFA and the EFL have come to this agreement, but it does appear to be voluntary. I think you've got clubs such as Stoke City, who are effectively owned by Bet365. And as far as they're concerned, they're in a position to carry on paying the full level of wages. So therefore, they don't want to buy into this deferral scheme. At the other end of the scale, clearly, you've got clubs in League One and Two who have already started to adopt the furlough scheme, which will cause complications there as well. In terms of an individual player basis, I think what is tends to be happening is that the PFA have asked their reps to speak to the dressing room to try to get an overall approach taken by individual squads, because I think if individual players tried to opt out, that would cause a lot of disharmony within clubs themselves.
I apologise if I sounded like I was shouting when I asked that question. A cousin of mine who listens to the pod, Kieran, pointed out the other day that I'm a little bit like my granny, that because you're far away, I think I have to raise my voice, like she used to do when she phoned somebody in Australia. She used to shout, I'm trying to stop that. Now, you've been speaking, I know, to Gary Sweet, the chief exec of Luton, and also Mark Palios, the chief exec of Tranmere, has joined Gary Sweet in saying this, starting to warn that we're heading for a situation where clubs could be going under unless something is sorted out. And I presume by that they mean the deferment of payments, do they?
Yes, I think certainly they want something to happen in terms of wages. Mark Palios has said that he thinks that the number of clubs that could go insolvent could reach double figures by the end of the year. Now, clubs going in insolvent doesn't mean that they're going to cease to exist. It could mean that they're going into administration. The purpose of administration is to try to protect the business in terms of its ability to ultimately continue in some form of existence. At the same time, going into insolvency is not good, because there's the costs of running it, and there's no guarantee that the club going into insolvency will come out the other side. Mark Palios is a very smart guy. He used to be head of the FA. He also has run an insolvency practice himself for PricewaterhouseCoopers, who are one of the four big boys in the world of accounting. So he's a smart cookie. He knows what he's talking about. I don't think this is scaremongering. And exactly the same in respect of Gary Sweet. And I did have a brief conversation with Gary last week. We're hoping to get him to come in on the show. He is very busy at present, as I'm sure you can imagine. So we'll just try to wait for things to quieten down for him. In terms of the upsides, if clubs do go into administration, then they can survive. They're effectively put into a further form of hibernation. The EFL does have automatic penalties for clubs that go into administration, but it's up to the club owners to decide whether rules need to be applied strictly or whether there is some form of mitigation as we go through the pandemic. Looking at comments which have come out of the Bundesliga over the past 48 hours, and remember the level of infection and the number of deaths in Germany is significantly lower than that of the UK. They're not expecting matches to take place in front of spectators until next year.
Next year, okay. Well, because at one stage there was talk of June the 2nd for Germany, wasn't there? Talking of administration, which again does make it look like we planned this beforehand, and I can reassure people we haven't. Although why I'm so anxious for people not to think this is planned, I don't know, Kieran, but this is not planned. The Daily Mail in particular have been reporting, which makes me think that it's not necessarily true, and that's not a slur against the Daily Mail, it's just that they keep talking about it because, and they seem to be the only people that are, but suggesting that championship teams could go into group administration. Now, this is something, of course, you know about because you've been an administrator. I've been seeing it twice close up at Palace, and it's not pretty. I mean, it can save you, and surely the EFL will relax their penalties in the situation. But all I remember about administration is, of course, they look to make as many savings as possible, and quite often that's non-playing staff. And I remember Steve Coppell wanting to pick Dean Austin for a particular game against Norwich away. And the administrator said no, because Dean Austin had a £4,000 appearance fee in his contract. And eventually Dean Austin said he would waive it because we had so few players. So it's not a happy experience. But if it's the only way out, then you have to settle for it. But the idea of group administration, Kieran, is that something that's common? Would it work? Do you think it's likely?
It's very uncommon. I did speak to an insolvency specialist just to run it past him, because remember, I've been teaching for more than 30 years now, so I'm very much out of the loop. He went through it and he thinks it's A, legal, and B, feasible, but individual clubs might feel uncomfortable about getting involved in it, because if you take I've given you the example of Stoke, there are other clubs in the Championship which effectively do run with the support of the owners, and therefore they are in a position to be able to pay all of their creditors as they fall due. So therefore you can see it from the perspective of those clubs. Why get the costs involved in administration? But also, and I think we're probably going to come back to this when we talk about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's comments, there are clubs that think that because they are in a stronger financial position, why shouldn't they take advantage of that in terms of the summer transfer market, in terms of recruitment and things of that nature? Many clubs were already in a very precarious financial position pre-COVID-19, and to a certain extent, a group administration, which effectively is zeroing out all of your existing debts, is a get-out-of-jail-free card for those clubs, whereas other clubs who are committed to paying their creditors will feel less happy about that.
I'd met the administrator in 2010 when Palace were going for it last time. And it's very interesting to talk to him, because, of course, he was a football fan, but he's not a Palace fan. But the one thing I took from his conversations was that every administration is unique, he said. Every administration has different circumstances, whether it's a business, a football club. That's why it seems odd to me that this idea of group administration, with some clubs that aren't anywhere near needing it, would seem strange. And it seems to me that whoever's doing the administrating, for a start, the clubs might not agree on the particular company that's chosen to put them in. And so, I mean, he said it was difficult enough to cope with one football club and all the pressures you're getting, not just from fans, but from relatives of staff that have been laid off, and the knock-on effect that has on other businesses. So the fact is that trying to juggle 24 of those seems to me almost impossible.
I think almost impossible if the intention was to trade the clubs. However, there is something called a pre-pack administration, which effectively, let's say that you go into administration at 10 o'clock in the morning, and at 10:01 the club is sold to normally the previous owners in a deal which has been agreed. So therefore, the problems which the administrators of Palace had won't necessarily come to the fore. But what it does do is it gets the creditors' backs off the club itself. But it doesn't get football creditors dealt with. So in terms of outstanding transfer fees and in terms of money which is due to players, those figures would still be due. If we take a look at the state of the Championship, we've said on more than one occasion, on average, the clubs are paying £107 in wages for every £100 of money coming in. And that's during a season when we've got football matches taking place in front of an audience. Well, that income's going to be lower. The wages, as we've established, are going to be deferred rather than reduced. So I still think that this nuclear option has its faults, because all that's going to happen is that your regular Joe creditors are going to be stiffed, and the football creditors are still going to be paid in full. There's not going to be no winners here, apart from one or two club owners are going to have to go and pay less money to people that they've been trading with, and effectively just playing this game of casino football for the past few years, keeping their fingers crossed.
For the benefit of this regular Joe, and I'm sure many other people out there who don't share your football knowledge, could you just explain that again? You can go into administration at 10 o'clock and come out of the administration at 10:01, and that's pre-arranged, and that has what benefit for the club?
Well, when you go into administration, all of your creditors are frozen. And in theory, they are then paid out of the proceeds of the administration itself.
Right.
So if you agree to sell the club back to the owners, it will normally be at an amount of money which would not allow you to pay all of the creditors in full. So on the back of that, they're going to lose out. Now, under football regulations, all football creditors have to be paid in full in terms of, my understanding, in terms of transfer fees and outstanding wages. So therefore, other clubs wouldn't lose out, the players wouldn't lose out. But if you've been supplying pies to a club, then you could end up getting, you know, 1 or 2 pence in the pound. If you're the coach driver, if you know, providing transport services and all of the other providers of goods and services to clubs, they could potentially suffer significantly. And let's face it, everybody in the economy is suffering. This talk yesterday by the Chancellor of a 35% reduction in the UK economy. We're effectively talking about unemployment of 3.5 to 4 million before the end of the year.
Well, there are some fans at the moment who are edging towards happier, and they're Newcastle fans because a buyer seems to have been, well, certainly been talked of, and it seems that a move is becoming more and more feasible, a sell.
Yes. I mean, Mike Ashley, in theory, has been trying to sell Newcastle for at least 12 years. So I think we always have to deal with Mike Ashley and the sale of the club with a degree of caution. However, there have been a series of documents which have been lodged at Company's House, one of which is a document between a company called St. James's Holdings, which is the company which owns Newcastle United, and another company called PCP Partners, which is a company owned by Amanda Staveley. Now, for people who aren't familiar, Amanda Staveley is a sort of an intermediary, effectively an agent. Mm. But instead of trying to sell players, she's trying to sell football clubs. And what this particular document does, and it is very, very strange, it's St. James's Holding is lending Amanda Staveley money, presumably to help her buy Newcastle United.
Oh.
Now, that seems counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, yes.
So the way that this is going to work as follows. You have to go back, and I've been through going back into court documents going back to 2016. Amanda Staveley also introduced Barclays Bank to the Qatari investment funds in 2007. You remember the last recession, and the last recession wasn't caused by a pandemic. It wasn't caused by footballers' wages. It was caused by the banking industry doing crazy things.
Mm-hmm.
Barclays was in a very precarious position. It could have gone into state ownership. It could have gone into administration. But instead, the Qataris effectively bailed it out as a result of Amanda Staveley introducing the two parties together. She is now claiming through the courts that she's owed at least £150 million as an introduction fee. And that's gone to a judiciary resolution. And when that court case is finished, in theory, the money she will make from that will then be repaid to St. James's Holding, who have given her the money to buy 10% of the football club.
Now, two things. Are you deliberately mispronouncing Qatari, or have I been pronouncing it wrong for all my life? Because I like Qatari. It sounds great. But secondly, is this a little bit like the Man United situation whereby essentially they borrowed money against a club they didn't own to buy the club?
I think in the case of Amanda Staveley, there is an element of that. But then we come to two other investors who have been spoken about in the press. One is called the Rubin Brothers. The Rubin Brothers are the second richest people in the UK. It's a classic rags to riches story. They've been very successful. They have all of the trappings of what you would expect from a high net worth individual. They've got the yachts, they've got the helicopters. But there's, you know, as we've established before, having an investment in a football club, especially a Premier League club, there's only 20 of them. That gives you something to talk about when you're having a chat with your mates in Monaco. You can invite them to the next home home match against Liverpool and so on to come in the director's box. So it looks like they're going to buy 10%. And I think the most controversial investor is going to be something called the PIF. This is the investment fund of the of Saudi Arabia. And they're going to pick up 80%. This does seem a little bit unusual in that Saudi Arabia recently has been focusing on hosting big sporting events rather than getting involved with buying a club. It's seen the mixed response to Manchester City and PSG being acquired by other effective state investment funds from the Middle East. But this now appears to be going ahead. And clearly from a Newcastle fan's perspective, they're getting quite excited about that.
Well, that brings me to a note that we've had from Guy, our producer. Remember Guy? The guy who produces?
Ah, the guy in the gold armchair.
Yeah, he's the one. Yeah, the one who apparently Zoom doesn't work as far north as Manchester by all accounts. So he's just he sent us a message from Paul, who edits the podcast. Now, this has come as news to me, frankly. Paul, I did not know the existence of Paul, who edits the podcast. I wish him nothing but goodwill, I'm sure he does a very good job. If I find out that he's being paid and we're not, then it might kick off a little bit. But this message from Paul, Paul is a Newcastle fan. And Paul specifically wants to ask you this moral maze question, Kieran. And basically, I won't attempt to do the accent because that's A, it's not fair, and B, Paul might not be from Newcastle. But Paul says, am I allowed to be happy to see the back of Mike Ashley, even if it means Saudi state ownership, because it's doing my fucking nut in? Which I think there will be some Newcastle fans, as indeed there are some Man City fans, who do fret a little about, you know, the politics, shall we say, of being owned by UAE or Saudi.
I mean, there are issues. There are some critics of Manchester City who, in their view, the only reason why Sheikh Mansour was involved with the club in the first place is to do with something called sports washing. And sports washing is the aim of improving the reputation of either an organisation, an individual, or in the case of UAE, a Middle Eastern state, through the involvement of sport, because everybody loves football. So that's the accusation that could potentially be made in respect of Saudi investment. You know, clearly there have been issues with regards to human rights, with regards to gay rights, with regards to women's rights in respect of Saudi, and there have been critics. Equally, you can say, well, what about Chelsea with Roman Abramovich in terms of the way that the Russian regime, you've got Fosun at China, sorry, it's a Chinese investment company. It's very easy to point figures. And what I think this will result in is extended bouts of whataboutery between different fans, some of whom will be jealous of the fact that Newcastle have got more money than they have, and some will be taking it up on an ethical and moral stance. Mike Ashley has been a controversial owner of Newcastle. I don't think he is the devil that he is painted. At the same time, he's not been a benevolent owner. And I think that's what's frustrated many Newcastle fans, going back to the way that Kevin Keegan was treated. Kevin Keegan had to sue the club for constructive dismissal. Mike Ashley has run Newcastle very well from a financial point of view. But if you bleed black and white stripes, you know, you're not interested in balance sheets. You want to see success on the pitch. I think the first 8 years of Ashley's reign, he spent an average net spend of $750,000 a year. And I think it's a testament to a series of coaches at the club that the club was only in the Championship for one of those years.
It's not just football that's used for sports washing as well, as you point. I mean, boxing, for example, Saudi Arabia got an enormous amount of benevolent publicity from the Anthony Joshua fight being out there, and a massive economic boost as well. So it's a clever strategy on their part, but it does work. And I think if there is a Saudi takeover, the one person it would be bad news for is Steve Bruce, because I can't imagine any Saudi billionaires being completely happy to introduce their other billionaire friends to the manager, Steve Bruce. They'll be wanting the Pep Guardiola type. Before we get on to another manager who's caused a bit of controversy, or as you might pronounce it, quantroversy, this week, north of the border. It's the decision to basically freeze Scottish football. It hasn't been accepted graciously by many people, has it? So what's the latest of the north of the border Scottish football situation?
Well, the latest position appears to be that Dundee Football Club effectively hold the casting vote. Now, there has been there was a vote last week where clubs had 28 days to submit their views with regards to changes to Scottish football, which would effectively freeze the bottom divisions. The aim was still to continue as far as the Premiership was concerned, but it would have allowed the SPFL to close down the Premiership should they have reached we can't go any further decision. Rangers were very unhappy about that. Hearts, who are at the bottom of the Premiership, they were unhappy about that because that meant that they would have been relegated. And clearly there were also issues in terms of playoffs with other clubs. So sort of demarcation sort of tended to be along the lines of how does it affect my club? Some were being more altruistic than others with regards to that. It's an awkward position for both the EFL and the clubs themselves. If football continues, or if we effectively say we're going to try to resume football in Scotland, then the SPFL, according to their interpretation of their constitution, they can't get more money to clubs, so therefore clubs might go out of existence. Rangers have a different interpretation of the constitution. They think that money can be loaned by the SPFL, so therefore we can sort of, to a certain extent, have your cake and eat it. Money gets to the clubs, but the seasons yet haven't been written off. So that appears to be the present position. It does change by the day. I've been looking at the Scottish press. It is very, very polarised in terms of the reactions from individual clubs. A lot of the language which is being used is very incendiary. I do think if things are going to be dealt with, deal with them behind closed doors and try to keep a lid on all this rather than clubs putting out statements on websites and trying to weaponize the fan bases. There's petitions on change.org to have, we met Neil Doncaster a few weeks ago. Well, there's something not very pleasant about Neil, which has gone out on that. You know, ultimately, he's a guy trying to do a job. And, you know, from our point of view, we found him to be extremely open, far more open than we thought we would have been got away with. So I don't think there's anything deliberate or Machiavellian taking place at the SPFL, but fans, because of their individual clubs, will not share that view.
This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply with UiPath, the world's number one AI-powered business automation platform. UiPath, the foundation of innovation.
At Outback Steakhouse, your wish is our command. Backed by popular demand, steak and lobster at a special price starting at $19.99. Come enjoy our bold center-cut sirloin seasoned with our signature blend of 17 spices and paired with a buttery, succulent lobster tail. Hurry in to Outback Steakhouse where your steak and lobster wishes come true at a price you can't miss. Steak and lobster, starting at $19.99. No rules, just right.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 nine-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Now, we're recording this on Wednesday evening to give Paul, who we never knew about, the editor before, a chance to trim it, tickle it, shall we say, before it goes out tomorrow morning. But on Monday, when we went out, when we recorded, they were still waiting for Dundee's casting vote. Where is it? Are they under so much pressure that the whole thing will depend on them, or have they missed the deadline? It seems slightly odd that this vote has disappeared into the ether.
Well, it is very strange because if you go to the BBC website, there is There is the voting slip from Dundee Football Club, which says that they voted against the proposals. Now seems that the SPFL are claiming they didn't receive that. So you would think all that Dundee would have to do is to photocopy it again, email it, and job done. But it now seems that Dundee want more time before making a decision. How much more time they require is undecided. It does also seem strange that an announcement was made on Friday evening when not all of the votes had been received, given that looking at the voting slip, it said you've got 28 days to respond. Mm. But ideally, we want the responses by 5 p.m. on Friday.
Does that imply then, if they've asked for more time, if their decision was clear this time last week and now they say they want more time to decide, does that imply, do you think, that there is pressure being put on them by the SPFL?
Well, I think that there will have been correspondence and communication, not just between Dundee and potentially the SPFL. But remember, the SPFL is effectively, it's a skeleton staff. Yeah, we were quite surprised to find that it only employs 14 people. So it is a fairly lean organisation. I suspect that there has been communication between Dundee Football Club and other football clubs, and Dundee are trying to work out in their own minds what they consider to be the best action. I think Partick Thistle, who are, along with Rangers and Hearts, they are against the proposals. This could be because Partick Thistle will be relegated from the Scottish Championship. In their opinion, Dundee's initial submission should be counted as a vote, and therefore that could go to a legal case if Dundee do change. It's a complete mess at present, and there's no sign of a speedy resolution. And I don't think it's reflecting particularly well on a lot of the people, a lot of the factions within Scottish football. You know, we know that it's very polarised, especially coming from the two big Glasgow clubs. What the correct answer to this is, well, it's well beyond our level of knowledge because it is very much a local issue.
Now, before we go on to our last subject, a little sign has come up on my Zoom window, which is covering my face, which obviously is very distracting because I like to see. One of the reasons I like doing this on Zoom is I can actually see me as well as you while we're doing it. It says this meeting has been upgraded by the host, which is you. I'm not going to press OK because every time I press OK on anything remotely electronic, it just disappears. So I'm going to leave my face covered and just disconcertingly see yours. And plus all the things that you do you put those things behind you to annoy me? Do you, those things with Brighton clipped the crest on? Do you put those on just to wind me up? And the copy of your book?
Well, I do this because I spend a lot of my time on television. Did get into a lot of trouble in respect of one of the books, which is on my bookshelf. Somebody took great offence to it, which I find very harsh. I've got the Viz, one of the Viz annuals up as because we're talking about Newcastle United. And as everybody knows, Viz is based in that fine city.
Of course. And if a man can't have a giant copy of his own book clearly visible over his shoulder while he's talking to the national media, what sort of world have we come into? Now, listen, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I think, has disappointed many people, including Manchester United fans, with his comments earlier this week in an interview with Gary Neville and Jeff Shreves, I believe. So it wasn't on Norwegian radio, so he can't even claim the usual I was mistranslated type thing. And basically, coming across a little bit like the Jacob Rees-Mogg of football, talking about the fact that Man United could be in a position with their financial strength to exploit clubs in the transfer market when the window reopens. Basically, what he's saying is United are a huge club. They will ride this out quite comfortably, and there will be clubs that they can force to sell players at a lower fee because they will simply need the money more than Man United will.
I think he's had a pretty harsh response. I don't think he chose his words particularly well, but what he's effectively said is that we are going to come out of COVID-19 and it's going to be a buyer's market. So what we've seen in respect of the transfer market in recent years, it's been more of a seller's market. You've only got to look at Manchester United themselves last summer. They were in the market for Harry Maguire and Aaron Wan-Bissaka, and they had to go and pay full dollar for both of those. And to a certain extent, looking at Manchester United and the transfer fees, it reminds me when I went backpacking in Thailand, there were three prices available for goods and services. There was the local price, there was the tourist price, and then there was the American tourist price, because American tourists just paid silly prices for everything. Now, to a certain extent, Manchester United are the equivalent of an American tourist. Everybody knows that United is a money-making vehicle, and therefore, Leicester charging £80 million for Harry Maguire. And I also understand that they insisted on cash up front for the deal as well. And we know that United have historically been paying a lot of instalments. I think you've said to me in the past that, whilst Aaron Wan-Bissaka, very promising player, you were very pleased that you managed to sell him for £45 million and so on. So this might be just Ole Gunnar Solskjaer saying, well, we're going to try to redress that to a certain extent. Manchester United do have a strong balance sheet. They did have over £100 million sitting in a bank account at the end of December. Now, whilst they have a big wage bill, they've still got big amounts of money coming in until the pandemic took place. They will be in a strong position coming out of this. And if there are clubs who are in a weak financial position, that will partially be due to the pandemic, there's no doubt about it. But I also feel that many clubs have been living beyond their means and just relying upon the next paycheck from Sky or the sponsors or someone similar, without really acting in a financially prudent way. Now, you and I, neither of us go to football to have anything to do with financial prudence, but there are clubs that to a certain extent have been sticking up two fingers or one finger, depending on how you prefer to do it, to the concept of sustainability, i.e. we're going to operate in a way which is going to ensure the club's still going to be in existence in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. The pandemic has changed all of that. And if Manchester United are interested in a player who they might have had to pay £50 million for in last summer's market, they could pick him up for 30 this summer. Is that exploiting the market? Well, it's taking advantage of market conditions, just as the opposite was true of Manchester United last summer when they probably had to pay over the odds.
I'm going to wait until we finish recording before I ask you which price band you went for in Thailand. I can probably guess. But basically what you're saying in your very eloquent defence of Solskjaer there is that what he says makes sound business and economic sense, but it probably wasn't the best time for him to say it in public.
Yes, yes. I mean, we know that this is going to take place, and I think we've already had this conversation in earlier pods, since the pandemic had changed the face of society. There's going to be huge impacts upon prices of property, of cars, secondhand cars, of many other assets, because we're going to have 4 million people unemployed. And we're talking about individuals' futures, their lives, their families, and so on. Football markets, it's just a distraction. It's just a bubble that we've got into. I don't think Manchester United are doing anything wrong. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, ultimately, he's Norwegian. He's got brilliant English. But even so, when you are speaking in what is not your natural language, you sometimes do choose your words clumsily. And I think if he's guilty of anything, he's guilty of just a poor choice of words.
Yeah, actually, I've spoken to Gary Neville on several occasions, and an element of panic does creep in. You just want to get out there as quickly as possible. You say the first thing that comes into your head. It's disappointing, though. I think it's strange, isn't it, how you perceive clubs and individuals, because you'd like to hope, as we did with the Liverpool statement about the furloughing last week, you'd like to hope that some clubs do have a certain dignity about them. Historically, they do. And I think both Man United and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer are a club and an individual that you're even more disappointed. If you heard Mike Ashley say it, for example, you'd be disappointed for Newcastle fans, but you wouldn't be surprised. So I think there's an element of that. Just to close in, your instinct, I think I already know the answer to this. You think this is going to clearly rein in the stupid transfer fees that we were seeing in the last 2 years anyway. So it's not even, it's just all across the board. Clubs simply won't be able to spend the amount of money that they used to on salaries and transfer fees.
Well, I think they're locked into salaries because they're in the Premier League. You've signed right. 4, 5-year, 6-year contracts. Transfer fees are very much of the moment. So all clubs will have had less money coming in. It doesn't matter whether you're Barcelona or Barnet. And therefore, if you've got less money coming in, you've got less money to spend. And I agree with you entirely. Manchester United, I think, have come out of the issues in respect of the pandemic pretty well, because they have done the right thing on many an occasion in terms of refunds to season ticket holders, in terms of not furloughing staff and so on. Liverpool have come to the right conclusion very quickly. I think you've only got to compare Liverpool's comments when they reversed the furlough to those of Spurs, and Spurs was clearly through gritted teeth. It was, we have to go and make cost savings elsewhere as a result of this. There was a clear irritation from the words coming out of the club itself, because they thought, here's an opportunity to save money. Let's save money. I'm presently doing a valuation of every single club in the Premier League, and Spurs are, I think the Spurs valuation will surprise a few people, because if you look at that constant trade-off between sporting success and financial success, I think these numbers will show where Spurs priorities lie.
Well, let's save that conversation for next Thursday then, because my curiosity about Thailand is getting the better of me, and I need to get Ali in to make sure I do stop recording before we talk about it. The Price of Football is adapted production. Next time you hear from us will be Monday, when it's our special questions pod. And if you do have questions for us, email us on questions@priceoffootball.com. And as we learned from the response to the question about red cards in the Sunday League football last week, it doesn't matter how low we go, we get as much of a response on social media about a question about a Sunday League team, just asking for a friend, as we do about a Man United or Liverpool. So do get in touch with us. Keep yourself safe, and hopefully we'll talk to you next week. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye, everybody. See you later, Kieran.
The Price of Football.
Bye-bye.
Price of Football.